This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, and I'm Robert Knight in New York. We're originating at WBAI. In today's program, our primary topic is the nation of Syria and the question of how long it will remain a nation. There are new revelations and confirmations over the weekend that the NATO base at Incirlik, Turkey, near the city of Adana, is being used for a monumental supply and transit of external rebels into the nation of Syria, which is now facing a refugee crisis after some 20,000 people are reported to have died in the months-long fighting to overthrow Bashar al-Assad. In addition, there was a precipitous decision by the Obama administration to release funding from the so-called terrorist list to allow a spokesperson for the so-called Free Syrian Army to collect funds and supplies and coordinate activities for the rebels that are inside Syria. And by rebels, we mean extranational forces, including al-Qaeda. In addition to that, there are concerns of further destabilization of the region because of the inability of Syria to completely control its northern and western territories, thereby provoking what may be an important crisis with Turkey in regard to the operations of the autonomy-seeking Kurdish communities, both in northwestern Syria and in northern Iraq, and also elsewhere in the region. So we'll be speaking about those developments today with Elaine Hagopian, a Syrian-American sociologist and professor emeritus of sociology at Simmons College in Boston. And later in the program, we will be joined by Ray McGovern, the former CIA officer who was responsible for daily presidential briefings through four terms of the presidency of the United States of America. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we are now joined live by Elaine Hagopian. Thank you so much for being with us on this day of significant developments in regard to Syria. We note your own roots in Syria, as well as your academic excellence and participation in Arabic Hour television. And Elaine, I'm so glad to have you back with us today. Let's begin with something that you and I and other people have been talking about for months, how the NATO airbase in Incirlik, Turkey, adjacent to the town of Adana, is now, even Reuters is reporting that it is being used to fortify the surprisingly effective operations of the external forces that are moving into Turkey from Libya, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and elsewhere. Can you tell us how profound a meaning the use of NATO facilities for this operation might be?
Well, it's extremely important because I think that the tone was set for, or let us say the signal was given to the world that NATO could be involved when the Turkish plane was shot down by Syria. And you remember they brought in NATO for consultancy under Article 4. Article 5 calls for much more aggressive action. 4 was for consultation. So the idea of NATO is introduced. And then the Turks began to mass troops along the border and said they would shoot at anything that came close to their border, etc. Now, Adana is right on just about on the border with Syria. And Incirlik actually is a NATO base, but it's a U.S. base. And it's where a lot of the insurgents, I believe, have been trained. And even though there's a repeated statement in the mainstream media that the Free Syrian Army is poorly armed and they need more arms and so forth and so on, the kinds of actions, the insurgencies that are being carried out by specific groups. The army is not a coherent group, but selected groups within them are being trained. You cannot go and kill elite security people in Damascus and do what is being done in Aleppo run around in tanks that are said to be captured from the Syrian army without having some sort of resources and someone training you, the fact that they are able, in some places, at least according to the reports, the Free Syrian Army or groups from within them are able to push out the Syrian armed forces in some areas, and then they get retaken, is, I think, significant of the kind of firepower and training that they have been given. So this is not new, and the Adana Center seems to be used for these purposes.
The operation of NATO and of clandestine forces. We are aware that Saudi Arabia over the past several days provided nearly $80 million, at least that is reported,
yes,
for this insurgency, this contra warfare. The nation of Qatar has been very much of assistance in helping move the rebels that they trained and supported in Libya, and perhaps some of the weapons from Libya.
They're coming into Syria through Turkey.
Can you speak about the operation of Western governments like the United States, France, and the United Kingdom, Western interests and Arab fronts for the operations against Syria?
Well, you know, there are very strong Western interests there. They not only have always wanted to control the Middle East, but of late, the U.S. has been concerned, along with the European nations, that Europe not become dependent on Russian oil and gas and pipelines. And they have been wanting to construct and complete pipelines that go from Saudi Arabia and Iraq in through Syria and directly into Mediterranean ports and then on to Europe and perhaps also through Turkey. So this is a very important facet. The other thing is, we know from the project for the New American Century, which was under the previous administration, actually earlier, drawn up by the neocons, that they felt that since the Soviet Union fell, it was now time for the U.S. to reorder the Middle East in keeping with its strategic interests, and in recognition that China would become, along with Russia, important factors in competing for the area called Eurasia, where you have the highest population and where you have concentrations of oil. So the idea was that we could shape the world through military means and aggressive action. Now, Brzezinski, of course, who wrote the book on Chessbook of the Eurasian area, I forget the exact title, but his approach was you use the military as a last option, whereas the Chanian gang were seeing it as something to actually immediately affect American interests by reordering the Middle East, moving bases eastward. And this was part of the whole Iraqi campaign. Had nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction or anything else. It was that it was a major area of oil, a major area leading into Eurasia, and the U.S. wanted to control it.
Elaine, one of the similarities between the clandestine operations against Libya and the current one against Syria is the presence of Al-Qaeda, or as you may recall, in Libya, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group was very closely allied with this entity that is referred to as Al-Qaeda, whoever they may ultimately be.
Mm-hmm.
And now the invasion of Syria is identified by anyone who is present or observing the scene as involving people who characterize themselves as, if not Al-Qaeda, consistent with the purpose of the institution. And so if Al-Qaeda is involved in the clandestine forces that are being funded by Arab states and supported by the United States, how do we place this concept called Al-Qaeda? Are they an enemy of the United States? Are they a friend of the United States? Or are they useful frenemies? Are they frenemies of the United States?
Well, this is interesting. You may recall an article written by Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker. The year was 2007. He wrote this in March 2007 in The New Yorker, and it was called The Redirection. And, of course, Bush was still in office at the time. And basically what that article says, which was a very important article, was that the U.S. Was redirecting its policy and, in a sense, recognizing that they, as they did in Afghanistan, needed somehow to use Islamic elements that were basically U.S. enemies to counter some of the developments, especially they were concerned about places like Syria and Iran. And so they were, in a sense, supporting arming, and they relied on Saudi Arabia to put the money up and, in a sense, keep the U.S. Hands sort of clean. But he writes very important, that's a very important piece, and again, it's in The New Yorker, March 2007, and it was a real redirection of policy. Now, for example, it's noted that the key players in this article, the key players behind redirection are Vice President Dick Cheney, the Deputy National Advisor Elliot Abrams, the then-departing Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad, Prince Bandar, who, interestingly enough, is up and running in Saudi Arabia, National Security Advisor, and of course, our Secretary of State at that time, Condoleezza Rice, was deeply involved in shaping the policy. And so this was a very interesting development. Rice, in fact, said before a Senate Foreign Relations Committee that there is a new strategic alignment in the Middle East, and, quote, separating reformers and extremists. She pointed to the Sunni states as centers of moderation, meaning Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Kuwait and whatnot, and said that Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah were on the other side of that divide. Syria's Sunni majority is, of course, dominated by Shia. So Iran and Syria, she said, have made their choice, and their choice is to destabilize, which is really rather amusing. So the whole idea was to get a counter in some of these Islamic forces to these Shiites, because they felt that the Iraq war allowed Iran to have too much influence in Iraq, and already this alliance between Syria and Iran and Hezbollah, and then you add the growing Shiite dominance of Iraq, and you have what is called the Shiite arc. And the Saudis, of course, are very, very concerned because they have a large Shia population on their eastern coast where all the oil is, which is just opposite Iran. And originally, what's his name, Kaz, who writes a great deal about Saudi Arabia, said that the Saudis had sort of made their peace with the Shia in their eastern portion, but in fact they have been rioting of late, and there is a real split there, and they don't like the discrimination, and now there's even growing protests within Riyadh and Mecca, which is, in a sense, a general protest to the Saudis, and the Saudis have been shooting at these people. So the Saudis have a potential break, but they're the ones who were and have been paying. Now, I would like to talk a little bit about the Al-Qaeda and the Salafis. The Salafis are jihadists. They are fundamentalists. They're like the Saudi form of Islam. They would like to see Islamic societies everywhere. Some of them, of course, would like to see the caliphate restored. But it's really Al-Qaeda which has always had as its program the notion that you must fight wherever you can to reestablish the caliphate and the Ummah, which is the nation of Islam. And so the Saudis don't seem to have objections to them, although they prefer to have their own people. But a lot of these al-Qaeda people originally were from Saudi Arabia. They're the ones who were fighting as Sunnis in Iraq against U.S. forces and Shiites. And now they seem to be coming in groves into Syria. And according to one author and expert, Bali Nasser of Johns Hopkins University, they're not big in numbers, but they seem to be setting up little pockets of emirates, which they hope to hold on to and keep converting. The interesting thing is al-Qaeda, in some ways, lost out in Libya, Tunisia, and Egypt. They really didn't participate. There were Salafis from Saudi Arabia, but they really didn't participate. And the Qataris were paying a lot of the Muslim brothers in those areas. And now in Syria next door, where you have a large Qaeda group in Iraq, they saw an opportunity not to lose out, but to establish some real pockets. Hopefully they think they will spread. There's friction between them and the Free Syrian Army. This is why the U.S., which coordinates the arms that the Saudis are paying for that go into Syria, they look ahead and they wonder if some of those arms are going to get into the hands of the al-Qaeda, which may give the U.S. short-term interest in trying to dislodge Assad and change the regime there. But in the long term, will they have opened up a Pandora's box as they did in Afghanistan with the Taliban? So it's a huge, huge mess.
Dr. Hagopian, the Emeritus Professor of Sociology at Simmons College, your granularity is extremely valuable given the history of the United States during the 1980s and the days of the Soviet Union with what Ronald Reagan called the freedom fighters in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. who turn out to be many of the same people. And in a way, everything old is new again.
Yes.
Because over the weekend, there was this stunning development from the Obama administration repeating the tactics of several decades ago, mm-hmm. this time in Syria instead of Afghanistan. And I submit this for your consideration. Mm-hmm. Over the weekend, the organization that is supporting the so-called Free Syrian Army, get it from freedom fighters to mm-hmm. Free Syrian Army, received a waiver from the Treasury Department to conduct all kinds of international support, both mm-hmm. Financial and logistical. Laura Rosen reports that the decision by the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Asset Control mm-hmm. means that they now have a free rein. This at a time when people from the Mideast are not able to send money home to relief agencies, medical agencies, or to their families because they're being put on terrorist lists. But suddenly mm-hmm. the Obama administration on the 23rd of July provides this sole exception. And the newly minted FLAC, a representative for the so-called Free Syrian Army, is a man who worked for many years with NATO and the U.S. Department of Defense, and just mm-hmm. a few weeks ago went over to the Free Syrian Army. His name is Brian Sayers. He says the OFAC decision is huge. It gives us leeway to support the Free Syrian Army mm-hmm. in broad terms. He spent 6 years in NATO operations in Kosovo and mm-hmm. Brussels, mm-hmm. and just now became the Washington agent for the organization. Now, he says that he sees his niche as to provide direct support for the Free Syrian Army and to stand up the Free Syrian Army, as it's called, as what he says should be the future Syrian army. He says, quote, in the near term, the OFAC letter allows for providing financial communications and logistics support to the FSA. That would include paying for salaries and provisions as well as communications, satellite imagery, logistical support for transport, which could mean anything from a 4-to-4 to supporting someone's travel to Turkey. He says it explicitly what's going on. And finally, in this note for your consideration, Brian Sayers says, our ask is for intelligence support, drone support, eyes in the sky, an intelligence platform. We need both intelligence and weapons. What do you make of this stunning
I think
development?
I think the U.S. is really revving up its attempt to dislodge the Assad regime. But at the same time, they do not want an Iraq. They do not want to see the army fall apart. And here is where the defection of the generals, but particularly Manaf Floss, who is the son of a former minister of defense, who defected, went to France when the Friends of Syria were meeting, and is now in Saudi Arabia, was interviewed by the Saudi regime. He's a Sunni. He comes from a distinguished family, if not a likable family. He recently made the Hajj. He went to Mecca trying to look very pious. And it's no secret that the U.S. and its allies, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and others, and Israel, of course, is involved, have been trying to put together a kind of transitional government, one that has a suitable Sunni army head that can control the army, and that would be Tlaib, because the majority of the army are Sunni, the majority of Syria's population are Sunni Muslims, and what they would like to do is some of these other defectors, the ambassador from Iraq, Nawaf Faris, for example, and then the ambassador to the United Arab Emirates, along with the Syrian National Council, which has been recognized by the Friends of Syria not as the representative of the Syrian people, but as a representative. They know it's fractured. They know it's a mess. The Kurds have often walked out on them. But somehow to mesh the sort of civilian look with the army look, to me, it looks as though what they're trying to create is a kind of SCAF. That's the equivalent of the Egyptian Syrian command of the Council of the Armed Forces, which basically has the power in Egypt. As you know, they suspended parliament and the constitution, and they did have an election. A Muslim brother was elected, but they control the power. The U.S. pays the Egyptian army $1.3 billion a year, and they don't really want to have a Muslim government that would have the powers of war or no war, break treaty with Israel, don't break treaty with Israel. They prefer to have the army in control. And I see this attempt with the many generals that have defected, but especially the big name of Tlaib, who, by the way, is corrupt, and I'm not sure the Syrian people would particularly like him, but they're trying to give him his Sunni credentials, along with some of the civilians who have defected, along with some of the characters in the Syrian National Council who are made in America and who often work with WINIP, the Zionist think tank of AIPAC, that somehow they can give it an aura of flexibility. They also like Floss because he has a lot of European contacts. His sister is has a kind of popular salon in Paris. The other end of that, which makes me develop the scenario I just put out, is this this explosion in Damascus, which killed four of the elite security people of Syria that were meeting to, again, see what they were to do with this rebellion. To be able to get in there and blow them up and kill them, it's a way of trying to kill off some of the intelligence group that have been orchestrating the response and the firepower against the rebels, against the Free Syrian Army. In the midst of this is the authentic Syrian movement that wanted reform, wanted democracy. They've been overrun. Nobody cares about them anymore. And or they have become part of the Free Syrian Army, believing that's their only alternative, especially as they see helicopters overhead. And given the history of the regime as not exactly being the most democratic. So I think they're trying to ready that that scenario, and this all this business that's developed in Turkey, and along with the Kurdish issue in the north east of Syria on the border with Turkey and Iraq, are becoming a kind of excuse for intervention, which the U.S. prefers Turkey to do. The U.S., given that elections are coming up, Obama would love to see a victory where Assad is dislodged, a government, a transitional government put in, dominated by the army that would control things, that could basically arrest some of the Alawite elite security people, including Maher Assad, and put them on even war crime trials and whatever, to be pro-Western, and that would be such a coup before the election. Here he could say, I got rid of bin Laden, you know, we're withdrawing from Iraq, look what I've done in Syria. This breaks up Iran's ability to be a dominant force in the area. And who do you want in charge of government? So I think that Obama is trying to build this leverage. Will he succeed? I don't know. But that's what they're working on.
Dr. Hagopian, in the few minutes that we have left for this segment, very big and important part of the puzzle here. The context you alluded to before about the massing of troops at the border between Turkey and Syria, the possibility that the NATO, Turkish, American, Qatari, Saudi-supported infiltration of fighters into Syria could cause a weakness in the Assad government and with the withdrawal of troops from the northwestern part of Syria and a de facto state of autonomy for the Kurdish community there.
Yeah.
And just today, even as we speak, now Iran is said to have warned Turkey about a military intervention inside Syria under a pretext of a Kurdish threat and such. And in the few minutes that we have, you, as a person of Syrian heritage, perhaps understand more deeply than some the complexities of the multinational Kurdish autonomy-seeking movement and the very real prospect that if there were to be a cross-border conflict, the possibility that may seem remote today of NATO then intervening because Turkey is a member of NATO and they have a mutual defense pact. Can you help decode that for us?
Well, I think that the NATO option is always in the background. I see the U.S. And its allies and Turkey because it's the one that's on the front line, and Turkey wants to play it very carefully. After all, Turkey really favors the Muslim Brothers, where Saudi Arabia favors the Salafis. So there's some, you know, differences. The Turks, however, are adamant that the Kurds will not make any headway with stimulating the Kurds in the eastern part of Turkey, which also is on the border with the Kurdish part of Iraq. As you know, the Kurds really lost out after World War I. They thought they were going to get a Kurdistan, and they didn't. They were split up into these different pieces in these countries. So there is the NATO option is always there. And whether it will be used or not, I don't know. It's up to whether the Turks can control the Kurds. The Kurds are not that thrilled with Bashar Assad. I mean, the Kurds that were in Syria at independence got citizenship. The Kurds that came roaming into Syria after that didn't have citizenship. Of late, during this whole past year, Bashar granted them citizenship. They have not been happy with the Syrian National Council, which has not been willing to recognize Kurds as having a right to some autonomy in its language and so forth. So now it seems that Assad really has threatened to use the Kurdish card. Now, whether he activated them or not, they were ready to take action. The last thing I want to say is that the Syrian regime can lose pockets here and there, and can be weakened, and eventually may fall. But in the meantime, they may govern over areas of Syria that do not match the present geographic borders of Syria, and other groups, and they're not coherent, may govern different other areas. So the government may get some control again in Damascus and some control again in Aleppo and over the Latakia coastal area where most of the Alawis are, but it may not be able to put up enough of a fight, especially given all the forces against them, to control all of Syria. And if I might just say, make one final notice, if you look at a lot of the media, whether it be TV or whether it be in writing, you find a name that props up all the time. It's Andrew Tabler, who is from Winnip. And he, when Tlas defected, pointed out how wonderfully helpful he, as a Sunni, could be in changing Syria. If you want to know or get some feel of the historical planning for what's happening in Syria today, you need only look at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy studies. One was written in 2007, May 2007, 2 months after the Hirsch article, by Seth Wickes, W-I-K-A-S, called Battling the Lion of Damascus, Syria's Domestic Opposition and the Assad Regime. And what he basically did was spell out how the U.S. could work with exiles, and he particularly noted that they should keep an eye on the Islamist movement in Syria, implying that they may be useful in the future if they can't get rid of Assad, a secularist. So it's a very, very messy situation.
Well, you have made it so much more clear. I cannot find the words to appreciate your clarity on this subject today, Dr. Elaine Hagopian, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Simmons College in Boston, yourself of Syrian American heritage, and also quite a bright light on the Arabic Hour television program. And we'll stay in touch because things are moving fast on this subject. Thank you so much, Elaine.
Thank you very much.
They're selling postcards of the hanging. They're painting the passports brown. The beauty parlor is filled with sailors. The circus is in town. Here comes the blind commissioner. They've got him in a trance. One hand is tied to the tightrope walker. The other is in his pants. And the riot squad, they're restless. They need somewhere to go. As Lady and I look out tonight from Desolation Road. Cinderella, she seems so easy. It takes one to know one. She smiles and puts her hands in her back pocket, Betty Davis style. And in comes Romeo, he's moaning, "You belong to me, I believe." And someone says, "You're in the wrong place, my friend, you'd better leave." And the only sound that's left after the ambulances go is Cinderella sweeping up on Desolation Row. Now the moon is almost hidden, the stars are beginning to hide. The fortune-telling lady has even taken all her things inside, all except for Cain and Abel and the Hunchback of Notre Dame. Everybody is making love, or else expecting rain. And the Good Samaritan, he's dressing, he's getting ready for the show. He's going to the carnival tonight on Desolation Row.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacific Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we recap that there have been some major developments in regard to Syria over the weekend. Among them, the announcement that the Obama administration has given a Treasury Department waiver to fund collection for the so-called Free Syrian Army, now under the Washington lobby guidance of Brian Sayers, who worked for 6 years with NATO and the Department of Defense in Kosovo and other parts of major NATO operations. Also, there is the threat of military action along the border because of the Kurdish instability situation, with the clandestine invasion of Syria, with external parties that are being aided by the United States, NATO, out of the Incirlik Air Base, as well as figures such as Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and others that were involved in the same kind of activities during the overthrow of the Libyan Arab Jamahiriya. To continue on this theme, we're now joined live by Ray McGovern, former CIA officer and presidential briefer, and the author of the outcoming article that actually is related to our focus on Syria today, and that is the relationship between Syria and Iran. And Ray is the author in the Baltimore Sun and other national newspapers of the article, "Is Israel Fixing the Intelligence to Justify an Attack on Iran?" Welcome back, Ray. Have you seen this level of clandestine military activity as we are witnessing unfolding rapidly in regard to Syria?
Well, I guess the last time was Libya, and the time before that, this goes back a ways, was the attempt to overthrow the government in Nicaragua, where the Contras were set up very much like the directorate that's being set up now, and very unseemly characters turned up in that directorate, almost all of them ex-Somocistas, in other words, Somoza's secret police. We don't know what is in store for us on the part of these rebel army people. But it doesn't look as though they're Jeffersonian Democrats. It looks much more like the kind of people that we would have been shooting up.
Well, Ray, except for the maintenance of slavery, given the anti-African bias of the ones who took over in Libya.
What about that?
Well, you said Jeffersonian. he was a slave owner. And the racist Cyrenaic rebels, who are now in control of much of parts of Libya, are very much engaged in a racist agenda of rounding up, torturing, and expelling people of Afro-Libyan heritage.
Have been doing that exactly. With respect to Syria, I have to tell you that it's a can of worms. This is the kind of thing that has spiraled out of control. Hillary Clinton, in my view, has made it immeasurably more difficult to work out an accommodation She's calling for the removal of the Syrian president, Assad, and it's sort of like unconditional surrender. What needs to happen, in my view, is to get all the stakeholders together, go to Geneva, get everybody together, and piece together what would be necessary to have an equitable and a peaceful solution to this thing. Otherwise, the thing will just spiral out of control. And, you know, over the past week, we have become apprised of the fact that not only does Syria have chemical weapons, but it's brandishing them now. It's advertising them, and it's saying that if there's a foreign invasion, we reserve the right to use these chemical weapons. Now, chemical weapons are not nuclear weapons, but they are weapons of mass destruction, and, you know, they should be a deterrent. Any sensible person, knowing that Assad has chemical weapons, that should give that sensible person pause. You're not going to knock the chemical weapons out with bunker buster bombs. That would foul the whole atmosphere for miles and miles around. And you're not going to be able to capture them by sending 5,000 special forces troops into Syria. So for Pete's sake, chemical weapons should be a deterrent. Deterrence works. Let's say, let's go fold our tents like the Arabs, go to Geneva or some other mutually acceptable place, talk the thing through before it really gets out of control.
Ray McGovern, then you cannot, on that basis, be terribly encouraged by two developments. One, the visit over the past few days by the Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, in which he was saber-rattling about, these are the final days, this is another nail in the coffin of Bashar al-Assad, and perhaps even more ominously, the announcement simultaneously that the Pentagon and Air Force have developed 30,000-pound trans-bunker-busting bombs, the kind that might have been able to do more than they were able to do against the bunkers in Baghdad and elsewhere. It seems to be a quantum leap in terms of massive effect of bombings, which might be intended either for use against weapon stores in Syria or nuclear facilities in Iran.
Well, that's right. What we hear from the American leadership, from the Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, is a pure and simple saber-rattling. And that's not going to win any battles in this very complicated situation. There is even some reluctance on the part of the Israelis, because they're smart enough to know that there's no end game here that can be certain. If Assad goes, who comes in? Is it true that Al-Qaeda is very active with some of the rebels? Yes, that is true. Is it true that the United States finds itself now fighting on the same side as Al-Qaeda? Bizarre, but true. So the thing needs to be sorted out by, what shall I say, by adults, okay? By people who can perceive of other ways to address these problems other than saber-rattling. The main objectives here, of course, is to deprive Iran of a reliable ally. Syria, of course, has been an ally of Iran, and Syria has facilitated the support that Iran gives to Hezbollah, for example. Hezbollah being mostly in Lebanon, actually Hezbollah being a main force in the Lebanese government. And so what people would like to see happen, that is the Israelis and the Americans, is that Hezbollah will be given a really bloody nose here, and that the Syrians and the Iranians will find it more difficult to support Hezbollah.
Ray McGovern, you are scaring me here when you're intimating that in regard to attacks on Syria that the Israeli government may be the rational partner in comparison to President Obama or candidate Romney. By that I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu recently said that he did not consider the Syrian acknowledgement of having chemical weapons as being a threat against them because they said that they would be used only in the event that Syrian territory is militarily, by another government as opposed to the clandestine one, invaded. And yet, there seems to be an inexorable escalation on the part of Washington, D.C. against Syria. Now, you've just written a piece in the Baltimore Sun about Israel's relations or antagonism in regard to Iran. In this piece, do you factor in the complexity of the Syrian step on the way to attacking Iran?
Well, as most people know who have been reading the papers, Netanyahu and his cohorts there in the extreme right Israeli government see a window of opportunity here. They would dearly love to give the Iranians a bloody nose before our election in November. And that's the name of the game here. The Obama administration, the White House, and even more so the U.S. military do not want a dust-up. They do not want battles raging out in the Persian Gulf with Iran. That would be bedlam. That would cause gasoline prices in this country to double right before the election. Who would want that if one were a sane president of the United States? And so it's almost ludicrous. Over the past 2 weeks, we've had the Deputy Secretary of State, Bill Burns. We've had the National Security Advisor, Danilin. And we've had John Brennan, the counter-terrorist fellow. We've had one other whose name escapes me. But now we have Panetta in Israel. We have John Brennan and then Panetta. He's there today. Now, what are we to make of all this? Well, you know what I think they're doing? They're all going to Netanyahu and said, please, pretty please, don't start a war in the Persian Gulf. Please, don't lash out at terrorists just because you say that they were supported by Iran. Cool it, okay? Now, if I were Netanyahu, I would sit back and smile and say, speak for yourself, John, or speak for yourself, Obama. And my bottom line is, and I'm afraid on this I agree with Netanyahu, if Barack Obama is afraid politically to say publicly that the U.S. will not be joining Israel automatically if Israel starts a fight with Iran, if Barack Obama won't say that in public, then what's going to happen? Well, Netanyahu will have the idea that if he won't even say that in public, once Netanyahu provokes hostilities with Iran, there will be no political option for Barack Obama other than to jump in with both feet. That's what Netanyahu wants. That's what he's probably going to get, because my reading of Obama is that he really needs a backbone implant, you know, and he's not going to get that from GW Hospital in time to deal with the situation. So if I'm right, and if Netanyahu calculates that he can get away with this, I think chances are now better than even that he will strike out at Iran in one way or another. And what really increases my thought on that is Netanyahu, well, some of you probably saw him on Face the Nation, not yesterday, but last Sunday, and he was also on Fox News Sunday. What did he say? He said, well, we have rock solid evidence that Iran and Hezbollah were behind that terrible terrorist incident in Bulgaria where 5 Israeli tourists were killed. We have rock solid evidence. On Meet the Press, he said the same thing. And then what he said was, look, these kinds of people, these terrorists, what could be worse than letting weapons of mass destruction, chemical or nuclear weapons, get into the hands of a regime that encourages and actually operates this way with terrorists? You know what? This is exactly the same rationale that was used before Iraq. Don't you remember? Saddam Hussein has all manner of weapons of mass destruction, and he's likely to give them to his terrorist friends, including al-Qaeda. It was all lies. It's all lies this time. Nobody is saying that there's any evidence. The Bulgarians are not saying it. Even the Israelis are not saying this, except Netanyahu. And American officials are also saying, look, wait till the evidence comes in. We're not going to jump on this. But Netanyahu has jumped on this quicker than I've ever seen him jump before. It was within hours of the incident that he said, Iran's behind it. So is Hezbollah. So what needs to happen here is he needs to be reined in. And I'm not sure that our president has the cojones to do that, or that he is credible enough to deter Netanyahu from taking advantage of what he sees as a window of opportunity before our election.
Ray McGovern, thank you for yet another facet of the dangerous times in which we walk today. And congratulations on your new op-ed in the Baltimore Sun and other newspapers called "Is Israel Fixing the Intelligence to Justify an Attack on Iran? Netanyahu's Rhetoric Has Eerie Echoes of the Run-Up to the Iraq War." And we know that over this past week or so is pretty much the anniversary of that ill adventure. And I thank you so much for being with us today, and urge people to follow your work at raymcgovern.com and elsewhere.
Thank you, Robert.
Always good, Ray McGovern. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow, which was engineered by Michael G. Haskins and produced with Thiago Brozel. We welcome your comments, insights, tips, suggestions, questions, and leaks with an email to theshadow, that's T-H-E, shadow, theshadow at WBAI.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Drop them away.